There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Something that's fascinated me for years regarding the supernatural, the paranormal, is the fact that there always seems to be these haunted graveyards, these haunted burial sites. And why are they haunted? Why would we elect as a soul to stay with nothing more than a rotting shell in the ground? And it's never been more prevalent than the way Hollywood produces it, talking about how we disturb Native American burial sites and how upset the spirits of the Native Americans have been. I would like to think that once we've transitioned from the physical form, that's the least of our worries. The materialistic world is gone. Why would we care? And more importantly, why would we come back to haunt and cause havoc for those that may not even be involved in the moving of the bodies or desecration of the burial grounds? So this has been a question we've bandied about for a while. One of our listeners recommended I speak to our guest this evening. Ronnie Headley is a 59-year-old Native American descent, originally from a small town near Birmingham, Alabama. Ronnie now lives in Chapel Hill, Tennessee. He's a professional paranormal investigator with over 10 years of experience on investigative teams. Through his own personal experiences, they reach back even further. He's here this evening to talk with us about this, share his unique perspectives and insight, and talk about some of the investigations and locations that he's had a chance to visit. Ronnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dave, for inviting me to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Talking about the idea, and especially, you know, Hollywood has beat into our head that most of the massive hauntings have to do with disturbing Native American ground. And I got to say, at some point, all of the United States was Native American ground, right? There are burial sites everywhere. I know in Minnesota there are mounds in many of the different cities and towns and townships. Why is it that, you know, was that just a convenient plot point for Hollywood movies? Or is there really something to the idea that disturbing Native American grounds releases some kind of supernatural force? And is that force the spirits of the dead Native Americans, or is it something else?
On the Native American side of it, my beliefs and everything are that the spirits are here because they want to be. It's not because they have to be or anything like that. They want to be here and close to us. And the protectors and everything were placed in these burial grounds by the priest and everything. So there's protectors there. It's not more or less to harm you or scare you or anything like that, but they're there to kind of watch over and protect what was left.
All right. Now, when you refer to the protectors, are we talking about a supernatural force, or are we talking about, you know, Native American leaders or warriors that, you know, their souls were kind of their job was to protect these burial grounds?
It's to me, it's a supernatural force, and also the warriors and everything are there to protect. Like I said, the priest would pray to and place people there to protect and watch over so that things would not be disturbed and robbed and taken.
All right. Doesn't it seem strange to you, though, in all sincerity, that we would be that concerned with the materialistic pieces that were left behind? Why would we care? And please understand, I know in some ways this can come off sounding very uncaring and unapologetic for what has been done to the Native American culture, and I don't mean it to be. I mean this across the board, whether it's white man, black man, red man, whatever it is, I just don't understand why the materialistic aspects stay in place, that we would care about what was buried with our bodies. We would care about our physical form. If we really are elevated to a new, you know, ascension level, why do you think that they'd elect to stay here and stand guard over, in a sense, meaningless artifacts? And again, I'm not downplaying the Native American artifacts, but in that they've been buried. It's not like something that was put into a museum and they're protecting it to make sure that the memories are preserved. These are things that could have been long lost and never found. It just seems, doesn't it, from your perspective, doesn't it seem weird to protect something that may or may never be found?
Well, with the Native American burials and things, some of our beliefs and everything are, a lot of the stuff is ceremonial or sacred that is taken into the afterlife to be used in the afterlife. And, you know, if you're disturbing that and taking that, it's taking away for someone in their next life.
Oh, so the old saying, you can't take it with you, only applies to, well, I shouldn't say only applies, but does not really apply to the belief systems of the Native Americans. You believe that when you're buried with these items, which I believe is what they did with pharaohs and other leaders of different sects around the world, they would bury them with gold or weaponry or food, their favorite animals, things like that, thinking that it would come with them. So is that basically what the Native American belief system is that by burying them with these items, this will be something that they're taking with them to the next level?
Yes, you know, the things that they would need for the next level. If, like if they were a warrior, perhaps they'd need their, you know, their bows and their arrows and their quivers, you know, things like that that they would need, you know, to protect in the next level. Same thing with chiefs and, you know, leaders and everything would be buried with stuff that was, you know, sacred to them, like a priest, you know, things that he would use. Herbs and things that he would use for protection and things like that. So,
what is, and I apologize again for the ignorance, but that's why I wanted to have somebody on with your background. Obviously, Native Americans were not raised under the guise of Christianity. So what exactly is the belief system in the Native American culture, and does it vary from tribe to tribe on what happens to us after we leave here? Where do we go? Where do you believe you go?
I'll explain as it was explained to me by an elder. There is two forms of religion in the Native. It's like if you put a canoe in a river and it was floating down the river and everything's nice, calm, and peaceful all around you. And then you get into a fork in the river and you've got to choose which direction you're going. To the left leads to spirituality and the light. And to the right leads to the darkness and the unknown. So it's your choice in life of which direction that you go. And the same thing with the Native religion. I mean, you've got the path of the light where, you know, you believe in spirituality, a supreme being, an afterlife. And then you've got the other that's, you know, goes into the different realm. And it's entirely up to you which direction you go.
All right, so is there a belief in a one great deity, a god-like character, or are there many different gods, many different spiritual leaders that the Native Americans and that culture believe in?
And there again, you know, there were over 500 nations in this country when in the beginning and everything, so each one has a belief system that is totally different. They have ways that are totally different. But most of them lead into the one supreme being.
And what is that being? Can you explain it to me from what you were taught? Obviously, God was not the name, right? Right.
It would be the same as God, the one supreme being. There's many names for him. If you look in the Bible, there's many names for God there. The same thing with the natives. There's Yehovah, you know, just... like Jesus would be Jesus, you know, in Cherokee. So there's different ways of seeing, but it all leads back to the same being, if that makes sense. What I'm trying to say is you know, that we all believe in the one being.
All right, I get you. You're right. In the Bible, it does say that he goes by many names, but it is God. So it doesn't matter so much in the title as what the supreme power and authority really is.
Sure.
Now, with the culture and dealing with death, what I mean, and I'm sure you've been to, you know, customary, you know, white settlers, you know, burial grounds and funerals and things like that. What is the difference primarily between the way the Native American culture treats death as opposed to the way, you know, a majority of the world does? Is it met with the same type of sadness, or is it met with a reverence and a, you know, this person is elevated to the next level?
It's basically about the same. I was a funeral director many years ago, and I decided I would go to Cherokee and talk to one of the elders about what the old customs were for burial.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back up into North Carolina and found one of the elders and started to talk to him about it. And a lot of the customs that we use nowadays at burials derive from Native, such as the Native people believed that there was what they called a raven mocker. It was an evil spirit that would take the form of a human during the day, and at night it would take the form of a raven and go in and steal the soul of the liver out of the body when it was before it was buried. So today, a lot of times are used to when they bring bodies home and things like that, people would sit up with the dead. Same thing with visitations nowadays. You know, you're going up and visiting with the dead and everything. That derived from them because they would be there and protect that body by staying up all night and protecting that body from that raven mocker from coming in and stealing that part of the soul.
Oh, really? So it was kind of, was that a way, A, to make sure that the person was legitimately dead by having somebody watch over, plus then you're protecting the soul? And how would you defeat then if this raven mocker did show up to take the soul? What was the course of action? How do you stop a supernatural force from removing or stealing part of a supernatural energy?
It was just the people being around and gathered in the prayers and things being done that night and the ceremonies and stuff for the dead. Same thing with, like today, you know, someone dies, somebody brings food, correct?
Yes.
To the home and everything. That derived from Native Americans too. Native Americans believed that the heart was a soul, and the heart ascended into the heavens. The heart soul ascended in the heavens 24 hours after burial. So what they would do is they would come to the cemetery. The families and all would be at the cemetery gathering and protecting after the burial. And then the friends and people of the tribe would come in and bring food to the family, and they'd leave food offerings so that the evil spirits would come in and take the food versus taking the heart soul. So that's where we get the day of bringing the food.
Oh, so it was like an offering that was being made.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting. All right.
You take this versus taking this. Same thing on another one of the souls was that they claimed was the bone soul, and they believed that the bones went back down into Mother Earth and formed crystals. That's why crystals are sacred to a lot of Native Americans, because they are the souls of the ancestors. So what they would do is they would keep the grave clean. No grass or anything would grow on the grave for a year. And if you go to a lot of the old cemeteries, especially in the South down here, you'll find that a lot of the old cemeteries, there's nothing growing. It's just white sand on the and rocks and everything on the graves. And that's where that tradition came from.
In disturbing the graves, was this one tribe's way of protecting their burial grounds from raiding tribes, you know, and other groups? Tell me how that was set up.
No, it wouldn't be just one tribe. There would be several tribes and everything that have the same belief systems and everything. like I said, you know, just protecting, you know, the protection of it and everything. And it's a lot of times like Hollywood will portray, you know, you'll see him riding through and the arrows come out of nowhere and kill people and this kind of thing. That's mm-hmm. not what it was intended for. It was intended for to scare you off, to make you sick or something like that. A lot of times, you know, some people, when they go into those areas and go in with not the right heart, will go in and, you know, they get headaches, they get sick of their stomach or something like that and have to leave the area. That's what it was intended for. You know, if you go in with a good heart and a good way, you know, there's not a problem. If you don't go in to disturb or rob, if you go just to pay honor or try to figure out something, if you go in the right way, there is a right way to go in, there's a wrong way to go in. And you know,
well, can you give us a little insight? Yeah, I was going to say, what would be some of the insight if you're going to go in to what you believe is a Native American burial ground with an interest in the supernatural? First of all, how is that looked upon by your culture? Is it an affront to try to communicate with the spirits of your elders and those that have crossed over? Or is it fine if you're doing it in a state of respect?
As long as you're doing anything with a state of respect, it's okay. You know, you get into a lot of things that are done in a wrong way. For instance, just like we do sweat lodges. Mm-hmm. And in sweat lodges, there's a way, when we do the sweat lodges, there's certain things that we do and ceremonies and all that we do, that we call in the ancestors for blessings and stuff in these sweat lodges.
All right, well, talk to me about that. What is a sweat lodge? There's a lot of us, we've heard the title, but have no clue what that physically means.
Sweat lodge is going in, and it's basically you go in, sweat out the impurities of your body. You're doing prayers. You're doing a cleansing of the soul, cleansing of oneself. And it symbolizes going into the womb of Mother Earth. And then when you exit out, cleansed with, you know, sweating out the impurities and prayers and everything, as a rebirth of coming back out and being reborn. And, you know, when you go in to the sweat lodge, there's different types of sweat lodges. There's different temperatures, you know, depending on how hot the rocks are that are brought in and everything, that are heated in the fire before they come in. And then there's water added, you know, that creates the steam inside to do the sweat. There's also herbs and stuff that's placed on. Like if you're calling the ancestors in, we use sweetgrass. Sweetgrass will open up portals for us. But then you've got to understand, when you open up a portal and you go in that direction, you can open up a portal. If you're bringing in good, you can also bring in bad. So you have to be ready and able and prepared to deal with what you've opened up.
All right. I get that aspect of it. Now, does the sweat lodge, do these open you up? How is it exactly? Is it a mixture with some form of drink or smoke that along with the sweat lodge that opens up these, which, you know, a lot of people would consider hallucinogenic effects, you know, but there's quite a bit said in many different belief systems that can open up your mind portals and third eye to be more aware and kind of see other realms. Is there anything else that goes into it, or is it literally just being in a hot tent or hot room sweating it out?
It's just literally being in the hot room sweating out and everything. The hallucinogenics, you know, you're talking like peyote and stuff like that. That is more the southwestern tribes. That's not the plains and the woodlands that were found here in the southeast. And we had no hallucinogenic drugs like that we used or anything like that for any of our ceremonies. About the worst thing that we had was the black drink, which was yaupon holly leaves that were dried and concocted into a drink that was given during a green corn festival, our ceremony, and the priest would make up the drink and pass it out to the men, and the men would dance and all, and it would purge you and cleanse you, make you sick, make you throw up, make you have diarrhea, these kind of effects as a cleansing, to cleanse your body and cleanse, you know, at that time for that.
That sounds like the ayahuasca ayahuasca ceremonies that people do as well.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the idea was by doing that, you were purging your body of what, toxins, impurities, and that was bringing you closer to a spiritual connection?
Correct. It was cleansing you from the inside. And then your prayers and ceremonies and everything was created to bring you closer to the Creator.
And in these moments, when you're doing these sweat lodges and you're trying to communicate, would these be shared experiences in the sense that you're like when you did them, would you see the same things as the other members were seeing, or would you see something completely, each of you having your own trip, I guess?
You're talking about like a vision quest type thing?
Right. Or whatever. Yeah. Whatever, you know, you're in there doing. I the only reason I ask is I've spoken to a few, Native Americans off the record that have done some of these sweat lodges and some of these other ceremonial practices, and they have connected with what they believe to be otherworldly, and I don't mean ghosts, but interdimensional beings. Some of them, seeing the mantis head alien entities. And that they will see it in a group setting. So it's once they get all to that kind of elevated position, it's not just like you're seeing a mantis head and I'm seeing the great buffalo and he's seeing the great bear. You know, it's not that. It's in some of these cases, the group is seeing the exact same thing. Does that happen, or is it usually just an individual experience?
It's more of an individual experience. You know, when you go in for prayers and cleansings and everything, it might be something that you're going in with your heart and you're praying for, you know, that your answers you're looking for, versus something I go in with might be totally different, that I'm looking for something else. So it's really depends on what you're praying for and what you're looking for when you go in, what kind of mindset you're in.
So when you go in, it's usually for a specific reason, or is it just a purge?
It can be either way, but most Native Americans go in with a mindset that they're looking for an answer for something or trying to get closer to something.
When you have done this, and how many times have you gone in for a sweat?
Oh, God, I couldn't tell you.
What primarily do you go in for? Is there a specific, like you're looking for an answer regarding life's question? Are you looking just to gain some spirituality? What exactly, and I understand it's very personal, but is there anything that you can share with us about your own personal experiences?
Some of the things I've gone in for is, you know, looking for answers myself to various personal questions that I had. Also, being a veteran, sometimes I've gone in to just try to cleanse my mind. Things that veterans see and do sometimes, you know, are with them for a lifetime. Same thing as being a paramedic or a firefighter or an officer. You deal things that the normal people don't see, and you do it on a daily basis. So sometimes it's just going in trying to cleanse your mind and clear your mind from thoughts like that too.
Oh, I understand. So it's helping rid yourself of these spirits or souls or attachments that you may have also connected with.
Correct.
Okay. And so many places to go with this. Have you personally had experiences with what you would consider to be interdimensional or alien beings?
Interdimensional or alien beings?
Yes.
No, but I am fascinated by it. I do believe there is a higher power. I do believe that there have been contacts here. I'm in the process now. For the past 2 years, I have been from Honduras, Belize, all up through Yucatan Peninsula and across, touring the Mayan ruins and things like that, and looking at the connections between things in space and stars aligning and this kind of thing that drew all of them together. And you can't help but believe that there was some sort of alien force or beings that influenced that when you get into studying that depth of what they were beyond their times.
Have you spoken to any of the elders and what they believe? I mean, do they believe that we're being visited by star people, by aliens, or is that really not even part of the culture?
I have not spoken with any of them personally. No, sir. I have not. But if you look back at mounds and look back at the ruins from the pyramids all the way into the Mayan ruins and things like that, there's a connection. There's got to be some higher power, higher being, some alien form or something that influenced these people for all these different continents to have the same type of, like, building the mounds, building the pyramids, building the temples, and all of them to be set where you could set occurrences like eclipse and things like that through certain points on those structures.
Right.
So to me personally, I believe there was some sort of influence there.
Going back to the native burial grounds and upsetting those grounds, I mean, there have been so many places around the United States that were once heavily populated by the Native Americans, and we built shopping malls and hospitals and schools and homes over these properties. Why do some get so active and paranormal, and others don't seem affected at all?
Because going in a bad way, like I told you, there's ways to go in and everything's fine, and there's ways you go in and it causes havoc.
So there are ways to go into a location where there were burial remains and respectfully build on top of them and not anger the spirits or the gods or the warriors that are there to protect the area?
I wouldn't say to build on top of them. There's ways to enter into them, personally. You know, if you wanted to go into an area, you wanted to try to make a connection and get answers and things like that and doing an investigation, there's ways that you prepare yourself and things that you do to go in a right way, that they know you're coming in a right way versus just charging in and, you know, that kind of thing. Myself and the team that I'm with, we believe in, you know, you don't go in and challenge and everything. You treat with respect. We talk to those that have crossed over just like they're here with us today. We treat them with that type of respect. And it's the same thing with the native. When you go in to a native burial ground, you go in and show respect and treat it with respect.
I want to hear about some of your investigations, some of the locations you've been to as an investigator that you've found the most active, and what you can do as well to protect yourself. Plus, what is the Native American belief system on things like cryptids? Are these beings that once existed, that currently exist, or are future creatures? We'll get a little bit of a perspective on that. Let me ask you real quickly here. The idea of cryptids, these different creatures, things like chupacabra or the, you know, the phoenix, the Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, whatever you want to assign a name to it, the hairy man. Is there a belief in the Native American culture that these creatures truly exist, or are they examples like parables that have been told, and using these creatures as examples of those parables and what, you know, dangers could be out there?
No, there is some beliefs and everything in the different native tribes. Each one of them, you know, have different stories and different legends and stuff that are handed down. But there are some beliefs in it. Personally, with the Cherokee, we don't talk about the Bigfoots and things like that. One of the things that we do teach, however, is the little people. If you're familiar with the Cherokee little people.
I am not. Can you please tell me a little bit about that?
The little people were like little tricksters and also helpers and everything with the Cherokee. Supposedly, if you were taken by them back into their underworld and everything, when you came back, all tracks of time had been lost and everything. You could have seemed like you were there for a day, and it had about been 10 years later when you approached back out from where you were. But they would do things like help teach the Cherokee to learn things. One of the big things is the Kituwa Mounds in Cherokee, which was the mother town, the originating portion where Cherokee came from up there. There is a story of the Cherokee were being defeated in a battle, and the mound opened up, and the little people came out and defeated the enemy and helped protect the Cherokee. There's also legends of, have you ever heard of the fairy crosses? The little cross that's natural that looks like a cross that's formed out of this stone and everything that's found.
No, I'm not familiar with that. No.
Okay. The fairy cross is another little sort of gemstone cross that's found. A lot of them, when they flooded with the dams and everything up on the lakes up around Cherokee and everything, it kind of flooded over the grounds where a lot of them were found and everything. But the fairy cross goes back to a legend that when the little people heard that Christ had been crucified, that they wept. And when they wept, when their tears hit the ground, it formed the crosses. So that's where the fairy cross came from. But the little people were here to help and everything. Kind of like in the Irish folklore with the leprechaun, that type legends and things like that. However, archaeologists have found in through Cherokee when they were exhuming some remains and stuff up through there, they found that there were Native Americans buried, and in the same cemetery was little small skeletons were found where they had been, little people had been buried right there with them. So,
I didn't hear that. That's crazy. Wow, that's amazing. Now, I know that in some cases, Ronnie, that some of the Native American tribes refer to the Bigfoot as the hairy man tribes, and they refer to them as carnivorous and cannibalistic, and that they will eat themselves and humans. Do you have any idea with your background the tribes that your family comes from, what their system of beliefs are? Do they believe that these are truly just another tribe of human creatures, or are they a subsect, its own animal creature world? How is that looked upon?
Like I said, mostly on the Bigfoot and that type, we don't discuss those kind of things. So I'm going to kind of avoid that one if you'll let me. I'm just not that familiar with, like I said, it's not talked about. We understand it exists, but we do not talk about it. So
interesting. I won't push on that. Ronnie, our guest for the rest of the show, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got more of the best in paranormal talk radio and our guest, Ronnie Headley, when we return right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. My guest, Ronnie Headley, as we're talking about the paranormal perspective of Native American culture. Talked quite a bit about some of the background and insights into your culture and their perspectives on the paranormal. I want to know a little bit about, now you're also an investigator, correct? You've put yourself out in the field to investigate claims of the supernatural?
Yes, sir.
How long have you been doing that, Ronnie?
I've been, as a professional investigator, I've got over 10 years with teams.
What brought you to the point where you decided this is something that you wanted to look into and investigate?
Throughout my life, I've had, I wouldn't call it clairvoyant or psychic or median or anything like that. I would call it more like a intuitive feelings towards being drawn to things. And things just kind of coming to me and just trying to figure out what this was and how to deal with it, that it led me to where I am today. I've had some experiences myself with seeing entities, you know, hearing voices, seeing dark shadows, things like this. So it just intrigued and built to where it is today.
And do you think that that has ties to your Native American heritage, that you have these abilities?
I think some Native American people have this. I kind of like a sixth sense where they feel things or are drawn to things. So, yes, I do believe a lot of the Native American culture and all has this ability.
Well, I want to get into some of your personal experiences and locations you've investigated and found quite active, but I'm also curious, what is the perspective of the Native American culture regarding things like demons and the demonic realm? Do they believe in something biblical like that, the theology of demonics, or do they believe that it's there is just good force and bad force?
Yes, we believe that there are good spirits and bad spirits. So, you know, it would be in line with you know, the good being sort of like an angelic type, mm-hmm. or and then same thing with the demon on the darker side. There is, like I told you before, you know, the two paths going either the light or the dark, and that would fall in both of those realms. Excuse me.
Sure. Now, you said that you've seen some things yourself. Have you ever found yourself in a position where you were negatively influenced by the paranormal?
I have been in some areas where I just got eerie feelings that, you know, I'm not supposed to be here, kind of like hair stand up on the back of your neck type feelings, mm-hmm. and just kind of move myself away from those areas. Then, you know, you go into some areas and you feel the sadness and the hurt, the pain. You know, just depending on the area that you're in, what kind of emotions and everything that you carry forward.
What type of investigations primarily do you go into? Is it business? Is it private? Is it a mixture of both?
It's a mixture of both. I'm with Southern Innovative Paranormal Team at the present. We do a antebellum home in Spring Hill, Tennessee. It's called Ripa Villa Plantation. And we are the investigators there for their tours of Whispers from the Past, where people come in, book with Ripa Villa, and then we take them through an investigation from like 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. in the morning at different locations throughout the premises. And we also do one called Spirits from the Past at Henry Holmes State Park at Chapel Hill, Tennessee, and basically do the same thing there.
Well, talk to me. Let's go to the first location you were mentioning. Tell me a little bit about the history and what makes that place so active in haunting lore.
Ripa Villa is one of my favorite places to go. Ripa Villa is tied into the Civil War. It was actually used as a headquarters and everything during the Battle of Franklin, Battle of Spring Hill. It was also used as a hospital for the wounded and everything there. It has a great history. The Chairs family that originally Major Chairs that built the home and everything, and his family, while his wife was there and everything, carpetbaggers came in and took the home. So when they came back from the war, they even had to run the carpetbaggers out of the home that took over and get his family back in the house. Later in life, it was purchased by a lady named Ruby Davis. Miss Ruby is deceased now, but Miss Ruby was a madam. She ran a brothel and a shot house out of there. And one of the girls was killed in the house. Some say it was murder. Some say it was an accident. We really don't know. So there is a lot of activity, especially with this time of year around November, with the battle, anniversary of the battle and everything. There's a good bit of activity in that area. So that's one of my more favorite places to go.
Now, when you say there's a good bit of activity, explain to us what kind of activity takes place there.
Well, we have a lot of EVPs from there. When we do our sessions and playback, as we're asking questions, we get a lot of answers. There's sometimes people can feel being touched, their hair stroked or pulled, or you know, seeing shadow figures, and we call them sprites, you know, the little particles of colored light. We see that type of movement and activity through it. So it's a very interesting place. I recommend everybody to come to try it out sometime.
All right. And then you were talking about a state park that you also lead investigations through?
Yes, sir. There's a state park here in Chapel Hill where I live, and the park ranger there knew that I was a paranormal investigator, and he told me, he said, you may think I'm crazy. He said, but there's been a lot of things going on inside this place, and some of our rangers and everything's had some experiences, and he said, would y'all come down and check it out? So we went in and checked it out and verified that, you know, through some EVPs and things that they did have some activity there. So they've asked us to start carrying people around there for them, too, on investigations. Henry Horton was one of the governors of the state of Tennessee at one time, and he married into the Wilhoit family. They had a big mill here on the Duck River, and he eventually inherited the property. The park rangers were telling us that in the beginning that they had gone into rooms that were not rented with their guns drawn because phones would be, lines would be lit up on the switchboard. They would hear doors slamming and people talking in those areas, and to go up there and find nothing. And they've had like rocking, there's a set of three rocking chairs on the porch, and one rocking chair would rock and the others would be still. They would see shadow figures in the lobby, that type of thing. But where the hotel and the inn is where the original home place was standing. So get a lot of activity there. One of the park rangers was driving around one night. She saw a lady standing in front of one of the cabins and in antebellum clothing. So she called to the desk and asked him, said, hey, have we got any kind of Renaissance something going on this weekend? They said, no. That cabin's rented by all men. So she started up that way, and the entity just disappeared. So there's a lot of activity there, a lot of the unknown there.
All right.
Right now, we're – go ahead.
I was just going to say, all right, so talk to me a little bit about when you're doing these investigations, how often and how active are these locations? Are you getting something on a pretty regular basis? And why do you think that these specific sites hold so much energy and so much power for the paranormal?
We usually do like every other month at Ripavilla as an event. Same thing with Henry Horton State Park. We're doing kind of every other month with them also. I think with Ripavilla, there's just so much energy there because of the Civil War, so much of the goings on and everything that happened there. I think there's a lot of connection there. And I've been with the team there at Ripavilla for a little over a year now, and I have yet to not have play back any of my tapes that we do during the investigations and not have some sort of EVP activity on it. So,
when you're getting the electronic voice phenomena, what type of phenomena is it? Are they basic? Are they begging for help? Is it, you know, kind of walk me through what you guys are experiencing with that.
It's, like I told you in the beginning, I've got one that, one of the investigators passed on to me that, that's on our team. When we go in, I told you, we treat them with respect. We treat them just like they're still living. So before we went upstairs to investigate the upper level of the house, I was telling the people that I was leading that night that were with us, you know, we came in, I said, good evening, Mr. and Mrs. Chairs, Miss Ruby. This is Ronnie. I've been here to visit you many times before, and tonight I brought some friends to look at your beautiful home and ask some questions, and hopefully you'll come out and interact with us and give us some answers. And then I start leading the people up the stairs. I get on the middle, you know, on the landing there, because we're lights out, and I'm holding my flashlight guiding people up. This one lady asked me a question as I'm carrying them up to the top floor. She asked me a question, and shortly after when we played it back, one of the EVPs says, hi, Ronnie. So, you know, we got a reaction of one saying, hi, Ronnie, actually.
So the spirits are aware of you and that you're coming there.
Yes, sir.
Do you ever find out why they stay? I mean, have they given any indication to, I mean, obviously that would prove that there is some form of intelligent haunting going on. But do they ever give any indication as to why?
No, they've never given any any reason as to why they're still here. I think there's some personal attachments, some things, you know. Personally, myself, I believe that, you know, if you want to move on, you can. If you want to stay, you can stay. It's not, and same thing with the native, like we discussed earlier. It's you're there because you want to be there, not because you have to be there, because you've done something that made you stay there. I think it's just a choice that you have, and I think that they're very comfortable there, and they want to be there. And from all the EVPs my other teammates have gotten and everything, I think they enjoy being there. I think they enjoy being able to still communicate with us.
Do you think that it's true consciousness, that it's a spirit surviving the physical form? Or do you believe that we may be getting transmissions or communication through time and space? Meaning we're communicating with the people that were once there and inhabited it there, but they're maybe responding through telepathic form from when they were alive, not realizing, you know, I mean, and hear me out on this. I know it sounds like I've been on the peyote, but I often wonder if, you know, in these dream states, when we're communicating with things that we don't know and people we don't know, I often wonder if somebody is not investigating my home 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, and I'm the consciousness that they're tapping into, but it's not necessarily a dead consciousness. It's just an altered state of consciousness. And that may be why they don't realize they're dead, because truthfully, they're not. They're just in a, you know, we're communicating, radioing back through time or perhaps forward through time.
I understand what you're saying. But, you know, my thing there too is, if it is some sort of time and space, why are we seeing shadows? Why are we seeing these sprites and things like that? You know, that's something physically that you're looking at. So there, to me, there's some sort of physical something there too.
All right.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I understand that aspect of it. I understand there's kind of a dual layer, but I just wondered in your thoughts what it might be for, like, specifically the spirits, you know, of what appear to be the old inhabitants of a home. Do you run into multiple layers of levels? Like, are you reaching spirits that were there in the 1800s, 1900s, 2000s? You know, is that going on? And if so, do they ever seem conscious or aware of one another?
Yes. In fact, one of our last sessions that we had at Ripavilla, there's different areas at Ripavilla that we go to. We have an old schoolhouse, we have a barn, we have a cemetery, we have the home. We have another building that's a new building that's been built on the property that has some activity around it. And going to the building, we had a medium one time that came in, and she said that she had felt that there was some sort of Native American presence of a woman and and children in this building that we were in. So the last couple of times I went there, I spoke a little Cherokee and talked back and forth and everything and got a little response. But the last time that we were there, some of the response that we got was that there was more than one and they were aware of each other. So I do think that, you know, when these entities are around, that they are aware that each other are there. That's just my personal feeling from some of my experience, you know, at other places besides Ripavilla, going back to Alabama and going into some of the mounds and stuff that were in Alabama. And there's a big, huge mound park in Alabama that I've dealt with down there. And
what exactly are mounds, so that listeners and especially those of us that are not as adept at the knowledge of Native American history, what are mounds?
Mounds was during the mound builder time. They would take the earth and build huge platforms of earth and square or temple shapes and everything. And they would have domiciliary, burial, and ceremonial mounds. What they would leave, it would be burrow pits where they had dug down and they'd fill it with water around the mound. So you would have like a civilization, kind of like where we were talking earlier about the Mayans, where their are the pyramids where they had multi structures in a compound. The same thing would be with the mound builders. You would have multi mounds inside the compound and everything, and that would be kind of the village where everybody interacted, be it living or the ceremonies or even the burials. But that's basically what the mounds is.
And you've been instrumental in helping to locate mounds that they didn't even know existed. How did you do that? What were you doing to tap into that, Ronnie? Were the spirits of the elders coming forward to tell you that, or do you just kind of pick up a spider sense, the tingly sensation that there's something here?
The lady that led you to me and everything, she and I had been working on a project in Alabama of trying to save some mounds and everything during the WPA era and everything, when they were the civilian, you know, the concentration camps, civilian concentration camps and stuff like that, where they were creating jobs. One of the things, I came into an area that was the oldest known mound site in America and the most unique site in America. And they took it down, and level by level, the archaeologists and these folks, to study it. And when they got down to the bottom layer, they found previous village sites with post holes, multi sets of post holes and fire pits and things like that. So, and that's as far as down as they went. And the county down there was trying to put a sewer system through the middle of it. They were going to tunnel through the middle of this and destroy stuff. So we got to trying to find it and everything. I went into the property and started trying to find it, and just got led to this one area. And just kept, every time I'd go to a different area, I would just kind of get led to this area, and just these feelings and everything, like, this is the area. And we kept working and working toward trying to figure out where it was and everything. I took a picture, and it's like, before I took the picture, I told you, you know, there's a right way to go into places and a wrong way. One of the things I did before I ever took the picture, I just kind of knelt down and I said, you know, Creator, you know why I'm here, what I'm trying to do, and what I'm trying to protect. You're going to have to give me a hand in this. And I took a picture. And when I took the picture and I carried it back home and looked at the photo, there was a face of a woman, looked like a baby in a blanket, and like a coyote or a dog face in it, right in this one area. And so I later found out that on the burial mound, the ceremonial mound, I'm sorry, ceremonial mound, there was a lady, a baby, and a dog found in the ceremonial mound, which is very, very uncommon when they excavated this place. And so teamed up with the state archaeologist, Kathy and I went down and teamed up with the state archaeologist and everything, and dug into some old records. And when we went back, we actually found out the site where I'd taken the photo was the site that the mounds and everything was in. So...
And you're getting these kind of, I mean, that's an amazing validation, especially in that kind of case. When you get something like that and you're realizing that you're that tapped in to the spirit realm, to something other than this natural course of what the rest of us are experiencing, how do you come to terms with that? I mean, is that something that you have to turn off and turn on, or is it just always consciously, you know, do you believe that you're always pinging consciously for these connections?
It's kind of like, it's always there. You just learn to deal with it and how to tune it out. Because if you didn't, it would just, it would drive you crazy trying to tap into it all the time. You know, the different emotions and different feelings, like I told you, you know, the areas you go into, you can feel happiness, you can feel sadness, you know, you can feel pain. So you just kind of have to try to learn to zone out of that.
And I know our time is running short here. One thing I know I'd be crucified for my listeners if I didn't at least bring up is the ideals and beliefs behind skinwalkers. And I know that there's some of your culture that's very protected that they don't like to talk about, and we kind of briefly touched on that earlier with the Sasquatch and Bigfoot. But is skinwalker, is this something that the Native American culture truly believes people are taking on physical forms, like we would think of lycanthropy and werewolves? Or are they taking on more of a spiritual quest as these animals by wearing the pelts, or, you know, taking on more of the mental attributes of these beings, of these creatures that they find to be stoic and strong and nature forces. What can you tell us about that? Or is there a mix of both, that they believe that some of it is just spiritual and some of it is true shape-shifting?
On the shape-shifting and skinwalkers and all that, that's not something that I am familiar with. That comes from a different tribe and their beliefs. So I would be hesitant to try to interpret something that they have knowledge of and I don't.
But in the Native American culture, most of the cultures believe in these totems and animal connections and spirit guides, correct?
Yes, like totem animal, spirit animal that kind of guides us.
Right. How do you determine, is that when you're going through sweats, is that how you determine what your spirit animal is? And do they change? Is it much like the astrology charts, you know, that as different parts of your life, the sky and the astrology is going to change because your birthplace in time and history is in a different part of the universe at this specific point? Are you maybe the eagle growing up, the wolf at middle age, and the bear in, you know, advanced age? Does it rotate through like that?
It does and can. It just, you know, like on totems and everything, basically what's around you, what you're drawn to. My native name is Firehawk. The hawk part comes from everywhere I used to go, or still go, there's hawks all around me. I mean, they just come out of nowhere. I just circle around or in trees around. So I'm always seeing hawks. So I feel like the hawk is my totem animal. That's the one that leads me and guides me. But as far as being changing and things like that, yes. As you change in life, your totem can change in life. What guides you in life can change you. That's why.
Can you change your totem? If you know that, you know, if you know that you are the hawk and you know that that's your totem, but that you want more inner wisdom and strength and you want this or that, can you change your totem to things like the bear or the wolf or the lion? How does that work?
If you study Native American religion, a lot of it will lead you back to a medicine wheel. The medicine wheel also has animal totems that are on that wheel and everything. And the medicine wheel is, the center of the medicine wheel is always to remind you, is a stone that's the creator stone. It's to always remind you the creator's, the center of your life, the center of your being, the center of everything around you. Same thing with everything that's represented by those stones, and in between those stones, the path. There's paths that the creator walked that you go to and pray for different aspects during at that point. Same thing, there's an animal totem that is to that point. So you can go to that stone or go to that place and pray to the creator and ask for guidance from that totem on, you know, to guide you where you need to go. And that kind of thing.
Now, let me ask you this too, is your thoughts on something, and maybe this is something that hasn't crossed your mind before, but I'm curious, for many people that are encountering spirits in their home, malevolent forces, whether it was once human or not, that are not being affected by calling upon religious icons, right? Whatever religion you believe in, and it's not affecting them. Do you believe that calling forth on the spirits of the protected ground, you know, whatever Native American culture might have been there, if it was the Sioux or the Ojibwe tribe or Cherokee, by calling upon the spirits, even though, you know, I might be the white man, if I call upon the spirits of the tribes that were local to this area, do you believe that there is some power in calling them forth? They may have more ability to protect over whatever it is that's malevolent in that spot. And do you ever call upon your elders and your forefathers to help you in a haunting?
I have gone in, like I told you, you know, with the mounds and different mm-hmm. burial sites, native places that I know, and even going into places that aren't native related and everything. Go in a good way. When I go into the native sites or burial sites and everything, I fast and do a fasting.
Right. I get that. I get that aspect of it. But I mean, do you think that me, okay, the white man, if I were to go to a location where there is something that is bothering this family and or individual, and we can't seem to rid it by normal means, and we've tried, do you think that we would have any luck by calling upon the spirits of the Native American tribes of that area that may have once been there and protected that land for their aid and assistance in this?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or would we be ignored, do you think, by the your family heritage because we're not of that bloodline to call upon them?
No, I mean, there's a lot of paranormal followers or mediums and everything that you sage, correct, for cleansing. Sage is a cleansing for us. That's what we use. We go in and do our prayers, our native prayers and stuff, with the sage as a cleansing when we cleanse areas.
Do you know what it is? Do you know what it is about the principles of the sage that supposedly clears the energy? Because to me, it's just white smoke that stinks. Why would white smoke that stinks affect a ghost or a spirit or an energy?
Okay, it dates back to biblical times. You remember when it talked in the Bible about going into the temples to pray, and they burned the hyssops and offered the hyssops and cleansed themselves of hyssops going into the temples.
Right, but your Native American culture didn't grow up on the theology of Christianity. They were doing it long before, they were doing it without the knowledge of what the church was saying.
My beliefs are, we were always thrown as pagan and this, that, and the other throughout the years, and heathen and all of that. My belief is that for the Bible to be fulfilled, then Christ had to appear for everybody, before everybody, and he appeared to the ones in a form that they understood, in ways that they understood, to fulfill the prophecy. So that's just my personal beliefs in it. Take it with whatever you want, but that's just my personal beliefs. And I just believe that they can, you can call on any of them, and it's still the same. Like, for instance, I told you I was a funeral director. My hair was long and braided. I was sitting behind the desk one day, and this new minister came in, and he was a doctor at one of the big Baptist churches there in Birmingham. And he walked up to me and he said, "What's with the long hair?" And I said, "I'm Native American." He said, "Oh, you're pagan then." I said, "How do you get that?" He says, "Because you worship Mother Earth in the four directions." I started laughing. I said, "Okay, that book you got in your hand, do you believe in it?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Okay, in the beginning God created man." He said, "Yes." I said, "He created him from what?" He said, "The earth." I said, "Okay, so God's your father." He said, "Yes." And I said, "The first man was created from earth." I said, "So who does that make the first mother?" And he looked at me kind of funny. he said, "Well, you still worship the four directions." I said, "Okay, let's go back to that book you've got there." I said, "Do you ever read Revelations?" He said, "Absolutely." I said, "If you look in Revelations, it says that there's four angels holding back the four winds in the four directions to Christ comes back for you." He said, "Yes." I said, "Don't you think that you should take time out of your day and stop and thank them for looking after you and your family?" And he just walked off, didn't say anything else. The next day he came back, he said, "You changed my look on things in a different outlook."
Mine said, too, Ronnie. That's great. Holy cow.
So he said, "I want to apologize to you." So, yes, and that's what I'm saying. There's different ways that it was taught throughout the different tribes and different religions and everything, but if you bring it all together and look at it closely, a lot of it intertwines.
That is fascinating. So, and I hope you didn't think I was calling you a heathen by asking the question.
No. Okay. Absolutely not. I just wanted to kind of throw that out there, right, where we was going with this, and
sure,
just kind of give you a
right, some insight on that.
To think about,
It's fascinating. What a great way to wrap up on this. Ronnie Headley, thank you so much for being a part of our show today.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been a pleasure. We'll be back again tomorrow. Our guest, Dark Waters, is back. We've got more creepy stories, more dogman tales. You'll have to tune in and hear about that tomorrow on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.